Last August, actually, this past August, the Times of India had a survey that they were reporting on. And this particular survey was conducted by the University Hospital in Zurich, Switzerland. The results of this survey said that overexcitement, or the period after some very huge excitement, can cause what's called the happy heart syndrome. Now, we think, well, that's pretty good, happy heart syndrome. The only thing is, the happy heart syndrome is synonymous with a heart attack. And they're saying that people who have this great excitement and huge excitement have problems afterward if they drop from that excitement. So the theory goes like this. The higher your happiness quotient, then the greater your fall when you have some adverse effects after that moment of happiness. So they went on to talk about that in this crazy world of pursuing happiness, there are now happiness clinics that you could go to help you in your happiness all the time. So they were discussing this. And they quoted in this article from a 19-year-old college student. He was interviewed, and this is what he said, that social media plays a large role in this pursuit of happiness. He said, we're flooded with visual imagery, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and the consumption patterns that we keep looking at of other people can be infectious. In other words, what's everybody else doing? And look, they seem to be happy. And then, well, we got to be like them. We got to be happy like them. He went on to say that the lure of materialism has snatched our peace. This is from a young adult, 19 years old. Materialism has snatched our peace. The point is that true peace, true contentment can only be found in the presence of God. And we find this over here in Psalm 16. Let's look at Psalm 16 and in verse 11. Psalm 16 and verse 11. You will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. So even though we can have joy at times and happiness, we're limited in the fullness of joy because we're physical, we're human. In fact, this is the conclusion that King Solomon came to as well. That full peace and full joy and true satisfaction is humanly unattainable. Let's look over at Ecclesiastes 1. Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 1. Ecclesiastes 1, verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? What profit is it? It's a question. He's saying it's all vanity. It's all wind. There's no substance. And then he makes a definitive statement about our limitations in verse 8. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye's not satisfied with seeing. It seems like there's always something else we want. And the ear, nor is the ear filled with hearing. So we are limited in what we can enjoy because we are physical. And we are not spirit, and we are not yet in the presence of God. I mean, God, we are in a sense in God's sight, but in God's throne, around God's throne, there's presence, there's joy and pleasure evermore. What's very interesting to note is that during the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Sukkoth, the Jews will read Ecclesiastes, and they will go through it and explain some of Ecclesiastes. And according to one Jewish scholar, he said, because they don't know why they do it in particular, but he said, perhaps it's to strike a balance of sanity. Because here Ecclesiastes talks about everything is vanity and worthlessness, and yet at the Feast of Tabernacles it tells us to rejoice. So somewhere there's a balance, and that's probably why Ecclesiastes is read, because the Jew, as this one scholar said, is to rejoice at the Feast of Tabernacles. And we know there are scriptures in the Bible that tell us that. That's the highlight of the year for all of us in the church. And in fact, we won't turn there, but Deuteronomy 12 verse 18 tells all of us, all the families, sons and daughters, that all should rejoice. And actually, not should, but shall. All shall rejoice at the feast. But I believe the keeping of the feast is more than just striking a balance between what Solomon wrote and us rejoicing. Because if you really think about it as we go through this sermon, we'll see this, that the keeping of the feast and its meaning, the meaning of the feast, actually helps us to answer a number of questions that Solomon presents. So as we do plan, and we are planning to observe the feast this coming year, let's notice something we can learn from Solomon. We'll look at a number of principles found in Ecclesiastes, look at some of his questions, and see that there are reasons now that we can be joyful and rejoice, and why we will be able to rejoice at the feast. So the title of the sermon is How the Feast Will Help Us to Be Joyful, How We Can Rejoice at the Feast. Now, Solomon had a number of other questions, and he took it upon himself to see why everything was vain, all full of vanity. Notice verse 12. He said, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under the heaven, this burdensome task God has given the sons of men, by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. Indeed, all is vanity and grasping for wind. I've seen it, but what I've done, is I've set my heart out to figure this out. Why this is so. And so what's the purpose of our living? And so let's notice what Solomon tried. Verse 1 of chapter 2, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, but surely this was also vanity. All kinds of pleasure. He tried everything, but it didn't do it for him. It didn't satisfy him. I said of laughter, well, okay, you laugh at a joke or something, but then what? You know, then what afterwards? What does it accomplish? Big deal. And then, well, I searched into my heart to gratify my flesh with wine. So even tried alcohol. Well, let's see how alcohol will do it. And you go through chapter 2. And he continues talking about various things that he had done. Verse 4, I made my works great. I built houses and planted vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. He did some irrigation planning. He acquired male and female servants, great herds and flocks. Verse 8, I gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings. So he tried money. He tried gold. Now today people think, oh, if I could just win the lottery, then it'll be great. It'll be fine. I came across another survey that showed that 70% of lottery winners are bankrupt within the first couple years after they win the lottery. And what happens is divorces occur and family squabbles. Well, sure, you know, $1 million? What do you mean you keep it all yourself? And you could just imagine what goes on in some of these households. And in this particular survey, it was stated that no one worries about the true impact on lives as they start spending. They spend it on toys. Toys. You know, nice big toys like BMWs or that type of thing, or all kinds of other things that went on to say, spending it all on luxuries. Then what? Then what? It doesn't buy happiness. Bad investments, scams. I know one lady told me, she said, and she was in the church, she said, I'm going to win the lottery. I'm going to win it, and that'll help me with all my bills. The only thing that was happening is, in the long run, she was spending more money going into the lottery than getting anything out of the lottery. And so it wasn't helping her whatsoever. It never works. Never does work. So Solomon tried everything. Verse 10. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. My heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from my labor. This is what I did. I went out and I searched everything. Tried everything. So let's keep our place here and let's notice some of the things he did. And we have to go back to 1 Kings. So let's look at 1 Kings 4. 1 Kings 4 and verse 22. Now this was Solomon's provision for one day. This is what he served for his household and those with him in the house. For one day was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal. 1 Kings 4, verse 22. Now, you know, cores, and we're not talking about beer here. We're talking about flour. It's a measurement of meal. And according to the pulpit commentary, this came out to be 28,000 pounds of bread, or 28,000 loaves of bread, each at a pound. For the house, you know, I have trouble eating one or two pieces a day. This is 28,000 pounds of bread for the household. And not only that, 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures. So you got the 10 fatted ones, and then 20 from the, you got 30 cows, 100 sheep, 100 sheep. And then there's deer, which venison, gazelles, roebucks, and not steers, but these are different type of antelopes. And fatted fowl. That's a lot of food. And he had it every single day. And he ate that. And he and his household. Okay, let's look at 1 Kings 7. 1 Kings 7, verse 1 to 2. Now Solomon took 13 years to build his own house, so he finished all his house. Now this is after he built the temple, and the temple took 7 years to build. He took 13 years to build his house. And he also built the house of the forest of Lebanon. And it goes in here showing how he put in panels of cedar wood and the various doorways and frames. And then in verse 7 and 8, he made a hall for the throne, the hall of judgment, where he might judge. And then in verse 8, the house where he dwelt had another court. The workmanship, Solomon had made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, so another house. And we saw that earlier. He had a number of building projects going on. And these were of costly stones cut to size. Costly stones in verse 10. And so you see how he just added more and more things to these houses. Now let's look at 1 Kings 10. 1 Kings 10, verse 14. 1 Kings 10, verse 14. The weight of gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. Now, according to some commentators, that the amount of gold here would be something like just a little less than $1 billion a year of gold, just of gold coming in. So he reigned 40 years. So his wealth and what he was worth by the time he was old was about $40 billion. If you had $1 billion coming in every year of just gold. And then you see in verse 18, moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory. So that had to come from some tusks, I mean, more than likely of elephants, and overlaid them with pure gold. And he had armrests in verse 19 on this throne. And two lions stood beside the armrests. 12 lions stood there, one on each side of the 6 steps that he made. So he had these carved lions right next to the throne. And it says nothing like this had been made for any other kingdom. Verse 21, all of King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold. And they were pure gold, even in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Not one was silver, for this was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon. Silver was nothing, like it says in other places, that it was just as common as any other material. And then notice verse 26, Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen. The point is, he did everything and spared no expense and tried everything to find out his answer. How is it that everything turns to vanity? What's the purpose of it all? What's the purpose of it all? So we go back to Ecclesiastes, and we come now to verse 11. I looked on all the works my hands had done, on the labor which I had toiled, and indeed all of it was vanity, grasping for wind. There was no profit under the sun, no lasting satisfaction. After he did all that, so he's very discouraged. Verse 17, I hated life. Kind of that's what we talked about earlier, that happy heart syndrome where he had all this excitement, and then bam, what's the purpose? I hated life because of the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, because it's all vanity. It's grasping for wind. And then it really frustrated him because he'd have to leave it to the man who came after him, because you can't take anything with you to the grave. So everything that you build up is given then to the person who comes after you. But Solomon does acknowledge something very important here in verse 24. He said, nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul shall enjoy the good of his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. So what he is saying here is work. And when you labor, enjoy your labor. And the way you can enjoy your labor is through eating and drinking. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment more than I? And he did all of this. But he is saying, this is what God is saying, how we can be content. We should be able to eat and drink of our labor. And then, verse 26, for God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. So that's another important point to understand, that he acknowledged that God will give wisdom and knowledge and joy to one who's good, one who's trying to do what's right, one who's obedient. But the sinner, he gives the work of gathering and collecting. And none of us want to be in that particular category of the sinner. Now let's look at chapter 3, verse 1, the famous chapter that talks about everything has a season. There's a season for everything, a time for every purpose under heaven. Verse 10. I have seen the God-given task which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. We have a hymn on that. We sing that. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end. Now, this is an interesting comment here because the work of God is far more than we can ever imagine. And God has endowed us with a sense of looking to the future. We're the only created being that can look to the future. You know, cows aren't out in the field today talking to themselves about how hot it is. And we can't wait until it starts turning to fall, so we don't have to be out here munching grass in the sun. You don't see cows discussing this among themselves about their future. Unless, according to, Dave Barry's comics, after the people leave, they get up and do talk to one another. Anyway, they don't. We're the only ones that can look to the future. An ability to look beyond. And this is an important key in understanding about the feast and why we keep the feast. Because what does the feast picture? Does it picture the here and now? Oh, we go to the feast to enjoy. We have a lot of great times at the feast with wonderful food and nice housing and fellowshipping. But what does it mean? What does it portray? It portrays God's coming kingdom. It portrays what God is going to establish on the earth under his government. And it will last forever. It will last forever. So the kingdom is not physical. It will not cease. And we have to recognize that when we go to the feast, we're going there not to just have happiness for the moment, but we're rejoicing because of what that pictures and what that means to us. In verse 1 of chapter 4, and I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun, the tears of the oppressed. They have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there is power, but they have no comforter. And that's the way the world is today. They are oppressed. Who do they go to? Where do they go to find some encouragement? And you know, you listen to the news and after a while you got to turn it off because it's so depressing. Where do people go for some encouragement? And it just seems like it's all going downhill. So where is some hope? But there is a comforter. And the world needs a comforter, and Jesus Christ is coming as a comforter. Unfortunately, Solomon didn't mention here that there's a comforter coming. King David did. In a lot of prophecies, King David talked about the coming comforter. Isaiah did as well. But Solomon, for some reason, did not. But we know there is a comforter. And then in verse 9, he does talk about the value of human friendships and family. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. If two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be empowered by another, two can withstand him. And a threefold cord is not easily broken. So we're talking about a family, you know, a mom and a dad and kids. And here's this indication here that we need one another. We need each other. Families need each other. During these times of oppression, we need each other. And that's why it's always great, you know, to come together on the Sabbath and to be encouraged by one another. Because it gives us the encouragement we need that we're all in this together. We're all fighting these oppressions out there. And we could look forward to the future. And especially during the feast, we have opportunity to spend more time with people. And that's great because it helps cement those ties. Let's look at chapter 5, verse 1. And this is something we can consider when we come before God on the Sabbath and at the feast. Walk prudently when you go to the house of God. Draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, because they do not know what they do and that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth and not let your heart utter anything hastily before God, for God is in heaven and you are on the earth. And so here we find this indication that when we come before God's presence, we're to come and be careful to hear, to listen to what is coming out from the Bible. And that happens on each Sabbath. We come to hear God's words and not to come with our own ideas and our own agenda, to make sure that our ideas and our agenda is in sync with God's ways. And that God's ways, well, that we need to be in sync with God's ways, because God is always perfect. He has everything right. So we have to come before God's ways. Now, we also see a blessing from God in verse 18. Verse 18, here's what I've seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of his labor, which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him. It's his heritage. And for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. Now, in these particular verses, we're seeing something here that God keeps us busy with the joy of one's heart. And it is God that provides us with wealth. It is God that provides us with the ability to eat and be satisfied from that wealth. It's a blessing. It's not what we as humans provide, it's what God provides. God provides this for us. We have to look at what God is able to provide. And when we recognize that, we can say, well, okay, this is what God has provided me, and I need to enjoy it because God has given this to me, and not look at other things because we don't have them. That would be covetous, but accept what God has given to us and be thankful that God's given to us what he's given us. And so we can rejoice at the feast because it pictures a time in the future when God's kingdom will rule over the earth, in which he will give wealth to everyone, in which he will give beauty and honor to all people. And God will provide satisfaction, because it'll be God who will be doing it. And Jesus Christ will be our King. And Jesus Christ will be our Comforter. And there will be no more oppression, what we see in the world today. There'll be no more vanity of life and uselessness. Chapter 6, verse 12 has another question here. Who knows what is good for man in life, all the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? And a lot of people today don't know what's going to happen. They don't know what's going to happen after death. They don't know what's going to happen in the future. Now, we know in part. We don't know everything yet. But we have a basic outline in the Bible what is to occur. And we know that God is the one who will bring about his plan. He's laid out this plan for us. And we just celebrated that plan on the Feast of Trumpets, where Jesus Christ is coming. And then we know next Sabbath we're going to be reminded of the plan that God is finally going to take the evil out of society. For 1,000 years, we won't have Satan to deal with. And we will have this atonement. And the world then will be able to enter a time of absolute, unparalleled, something that has never happened before, of God running things. Jesus as the king over all. So we now have responsibilities. And we find those in chapter 7, verse 8. Let's look at chapter 7, verse 8. The end of the thing is better than its beginning. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of souls. So we're told, okay, be patient. Don't be proud in spirit. We need to be humble. Don't hasten to be angry. Need to cut that back. Don't get so upset so easily. This is what we need to be doing now. Our responsibilities now. Verse 16. Do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp this. Grasp this. And we're talking about those who approach life in a self-righteous manner and not focused on the righteousness that God gives that person. And, of course, it's always good to do what we can to be righteous. But let me give you an example. There was one person some time ago called me that I knew years ago in another area. And he had retired from his job. So I asked him, well, where are you going? Just kind of out of curiosity, where are you going for service, church? Oh, I'm not really going anywhere. Oh, okay. Well, what are you doing now that you're retired? He said, I read the Bible. Oh, okay. That's good. I mean, there's nothing wrong with reading the Bible. And he says, yeah, I do it 8 hours a day. I said, well, okay. Again, there's nothing wrong with reading the Bible, but he was so focused on what he was doing in his righteousness. And the Bible says, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. And I said, reading the Bible is good, but it also says we've got to keep the Sabbath. Got to keep the holy days. So I'm hoping that one of these days he'll be able to do that, which I hope so. He's a very good friend of ours. And I've known of some people who will do that, but they don't realize that all righteousness comes from God as we yield to him. Now, of course, we have to obey God and do those things that are pleasing to him. And then don't be wicked. So there's this balance that we have to have. And we begin to now see a conclusion that Solomon is coming to. And we see that in verse 18, the last part of verse 18, he who fears God will escape them all. Oh, he who fears God. So we begin to see something that we will notice a little later. But even now in the next chapter, chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 12. Chapter 8, verse 12. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he does not fear before God. So it's mentioned there twice about the need to fear God. He's coming to answer some of his questions. The need to fear God. And it's repeated in verse 7 to 16. When I applied to my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that's done on earth, even though no one sees, even though no one sees, even though one sees no sleep day or night, then I saw all the work of God. A man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Though a man labors to discover it, he will not find it. Moreover, though a wise man attempts to know it, he will not be able to find it. So our calling actually comes from God. As humans, we cannot come to the answers of life on our own. We need God to guide us. And we need God's revelations to guide us into all truth. And so, what do we have? What has God blessed us with? He's given us His knowledge. He's given us His truth. He's given us the ability to enjoy our labors, even in this life. And there's something else. And we'll keep our place here. And let's look at Zephaniah 3. Zephaniah 3. And Zephaniah is in the back of the Old Testament. Where is it? After Habakkuk. Before Haggai. Zephaniah 3, verse 14. And this is encouraging to read here. Sing, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O Israel. Be glad and rejoice with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. The Lord has taken away your judgments, has cast out your enemy. The King of Israel, the Lord is in your midst. You shall see disaster no more. It's going to end. No more disaster. In that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, do not fear. Zion, let not your hands be weak. The Lord your God is in your midst. The Mighty One will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will quiet you with His love. He will rejoice over you with singing. The Lord God, Jesus Christ, is going to be so encouraged and so happy about what's happened in the plan that He's actually going to be singing. Can you imagine? We're going to actually hear our King sing, and He'll rejoice over us and be glad, and no more disaster. It's just an amazing concept to consider. How God is looking forward to this time. How Jesus Christ is looking forward to this time as well. All right, let's go back to chapter 10, Ecclesiastes now. Ecclesiastes 10, verse 16. Ecclesiastes 10, verse 16. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles, and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. So at the time when Jesus Christ returns, He will be king over the earth. David will be king over Israel. And then you have the line of David being these princes, and they're going to be nobles. And you're not going to have these kings who are in the physical world today who don't care about people. And all they do is drink wine in the morning. They don't even care about their appointment schedules or whatever. They just do whatever they want to do. That time's coming to an end. And we can be thankful that Jesus Christ is going to come, and He'll be wise, and He'll be understanding, and He'll be a counselor, and He will lead rightly. That's the blessing that we look forward to. And again, we note some of our responsibilities over here in chapter 9. Chapter 9, verse 8. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which He's given you under the sun, all the days of your vanity. For that is your portion in life and the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. There's no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. And so we find that we must labor as best as we can with all of our might, and especially when it comes to our families and our marriages. We need to strengthen our marriages and our family. And we realize that it says in verse 8, just look at verse 8, let your garments always be white. And we know that according to Revelation, righteousness, our garments are righteousness. And so we need to be white in how we live. And we must be righteous in how we live. Got to be doing the best we can. Now we come to chapter 11. Chapter 11, and let's look at verse 4 and 5. He observes the wind will not sow. He regards the clouds will not reap. If we get so discouraged by the world around us and we kind of close up and we don't do anything with our lives, it's just like, well, it's windy outside, so I'm not going to sow. Or, I don't know, it's raining, I'm not going to reap. I'm not going to do anything. We have to do everything with our might. And we cannot allow the circumstances of the world around us to discourage us from doing what is right and what is good. And we got to remember the great power of God. And he tells us here that power, how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with child. You do not know the works of God who makes everything. And God makes everything. This is an important point. I'm sure you did as well. I thought the sermonette was fascinating to consider with how God is so concerned for children. All these children that have ever been born and may not have been able to live out their full life, they're going to be resurrected. And they're going to have this opportunity in the second resurrection. And I think during the millennium, the time of the millennium, you know, we're all looking forward into the future. And the millennium is just not going to be static. We're going to be looking forward to those times when there's going to be that great resurrection of all these billions of people, including all these children. And here you have this statement made by God that how do we know how the bones grow in the womb? We see it. We see it on the sonograms that they grow. But then you watch these little kids grow. And we just saw Skype of our granddaughter. She's not a baby anymore. She's a little granddaughter. And she's walking and running. And we want to see her soon. So it's just how fast they all grow. They all grow. And God's going to give them all opportunities, all these little kids that have been born, opportunities to be in the kingdom. So I thought it was very encouraging what we heard. And this is what we're all going to be looking forward to. We're just not going to be static in the millennium. We're going to be looking beyond and beyond because there's always something we look forward to. As we saw earlier in Ecclesiastes, that God has put something into our mind of looking to the future of eternity. So it's very encouraging to look forward to that. And now we come to the youth, to all those who are still young. Verse 9, rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Enjoy it. Walk in the ways of your heart, the eyes of your side of your eyes. But know this, that God will bring you into judgment. This is to all the youth, and all of us as well. God will bring all of us into judgment as to what we do in our lives. So we got to make sure we're doing what is right. Therefore, remove sorrow from the heart. Don't be discouraged. There are too many people today that are discouraged and frustrated because they don't have any hope. Put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. Because you see, you grow out of that, and then you become adults. And we got, you know, difficulties as we age, but enjoy your youth, but do things in the right way. That is what God is telling the youth here to do. And we come to chapter 12, verse 13. Chapter 12, verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments. So we see that Solomon was leading up to this in a couple chapters before. We see his total conclusion. You got to fear God and keep His commandments. This is man's all. God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. So the conclusion of Solomon's search is fear God. Trust Him. Rely on Him. And this is exactly what we're going to be learning at the feast. It's very interesting what we find over here in Deuteronomy 14. Deuteronomy 14. Verse 23. Deuteronomy 14, verse 23. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where He chooses to make His name abide, the tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil and the firstborn of your herds and flocks. Why? That you may learn to fear the Lord your God always, not just at the feast, but at all times, always. The purpose of the feast, the main purpose, is spiritual. It is spiritual. We're to learn to fear God, and that the fear of God is what brings satisfaction that physical things cannot bring. The only true satisfaction is what God will bring us in the future. And that's eternal life in His kingdom, in which there will be lasting wealth and lasting pleasure forever because we'll be in the presence of God. Remember, God's throne is coming down under the new heavens and new earth, and we will all be in the presence of God. The Feast of Tabernacles, the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles actually answers a lot of Solomon's questions about all this vanity and things, and why do we do this and why do we do that? Because there is a future, and the feast pictures a time of when the government of God is going to rule over the earth, something mankind has never experienced before except for Adam and Eve before they took of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. In that garden, when they were there, before Satan entered, they were under God's government. And this beautiful relationship they had. And now all peoples will be able to be under that type of government in the future. That's what we look forward to. Now, the Jewish people, when you talk to them about Sukkoth, the Feast of Booths, all they understand about the Feast of Booths or Tabernacles is, well, the children of Israel had to live in booths as they came out of Egypt. And that's what we are being reminded of when we keep the Feast of Sukkoth or Feast of Booths. They're looking back. They're looking back. And it's true. They did. And it's true. We could find it in the Bible that they did keep the Feast of Booths to be reminded of coming out of Egypt. We keep the Feast of Tabernacles as a guide to what's going to happen in the future. A great second resurrection is going to occur before the millennium begins. Did I say second resurrection? I meant second Exodus. Second Exodus is going to occur before the millennium begins. And all these people are going to be coming back into the land. And it's something we look forward to in the future. Solomon pointed out that true satisfaction cannot be found in the physical. And that's why we need the spiritual. We need to fear God. By keeping the feast, we're going to learn more about how to fear God. I hope we can. I hope we can listen to those words that come out of the Bible and apply it. And how am I going to learn to fear God even more so? That's the key. That is the key to be able to come to understanding the purpose in life. In conclusion, then, let's look at Malachi 3. Malachi 3. Malachi 3 and verse 16. Then those who feared the Lord. So here is a category of people who have feared God. They've learned to fear God always. These are people who spoke to one another. The Lord listened. He heard them. As we speak to one another here, you know, in conversation and fellowshipping. And a book of remembrance was written before him for those who fear the Lord. So this is mentioned twice in this verse. Those who fear the Lord, God hears. Those who fear the Lord are written in a book of remembrance. Those who meditate on his name are those who are written in the book of remembrance. This is what God wants us to understand. And Solomon came to that point. Finally, that last, he was leading up to it, but he recognized the only way for this true satisfaction to occur is from fearing God. So we need to learn more about how to do that at the Feast of Tabernacles, because we see the end result here. It says in verse 17, "They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, on the day that I make them my jewels. I will spare them as a man spares his own son who serves him." We will be the jewels of God. And so we got to be reminded of where true contentment, true joy comes from. And eventually we will be in his kingdom. And that's something we all look forward to. And so let's look forward to this year with keeping the feast with all of its meaning. And we hope everyone all has a very enjoyable feast. And we'll see you when we all return.